The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. This week, we're at Nokia World in London, peering behind the scenes at the headlines making waves in the technology ocean this week. And guess what? Nokia's corporate challenges top the list of our news stories, so keep listening to find out what's happening. We'll be hearing from game developer Jane McGonigal from the Institute for the Future about the good that games can do. Joining me on today's program are Charles Arthur, technology editor at The Guardian, and Michael Gartenberg from The Garten Blog. Stay tuned to Tech Weekly for the next 30 minutes for the latest headlines and the best commentary from The Guardian. First up, it's this week's news. And earlier today, Charles Arthur caught up with Michael Gartenberg to discuss the latest headlines. And it's all change at the top of Finnish mobile giant Nokia. This week, we witnessed the ascension of Stephen Elop, the former president of Microsoft's business division, to the top banana slot here at Nokia, after their previous CEO, Olli-Pekka Kalliasvo, was removed from the position.
Nokia's been having problems, not in terms of its revenues. The revenues of its mobile division have been going up over the past few years, but its profits have been falling off quite seriously. And it seems to be losing ground to first the iPhone and then more significantly Android in the wider top end of the smartphone. That's its problem, which seems to be that the price it's getting, the profit it's getting per phone is actually dropping year by year. Michael, what do you think Stephen Elop will do for the company?
What he has to do is reinvigorate the brand with the consumer worldwide. And that's why I said you look at Nokia and you have to look at almost two different stories. On one hand, they sell quite a few devices. They have quite commanding market share throughout the world once you get outside of the United States. But over the last several years, they've lost mind share. People don't look to the Nokia platforms anymore and the Nokia devices as the leader of the market, where cutting-edge design is.
Does mindshare matter?
Mindshare matters because mindshare leads to market share. Loss of mindshare leads to loss of market share. And Apple demonstrated this. When the iPhone launched, it was dismissed by Nokia, it was dismissed by Palm, it was dismissed by Microsoft because they said no market share. Company has never built a phone. What damage could this company do? And they discovered that Apple created tremendous mindshare, which created user awareness, which eventually created quite powerful market share. And today, when people talk about innovation in the phone space, they're typically thinking iPhone, or they're thinking a new Android device. They're not necessarily thinking of the Nokia N series the way they once have. And that means they're not willing to pay that premium anymore. And that's why we're seeing the declining price points.
And we also saw the resignation of the markets executive vice president, the head of mobile, basically, Anssi van Jyrki, after nearly a decade of service with the company. He had joined as the head of mobile in July and had a sort of a sparky blog post saying the fight back starts here. What's going on, Michael? Is this a coup?
Well, I don't think it's a coup, but it's not uncommon when you have a departing CEO that other people in the organization who maybe were hoping they were going to get the job, or they've decided that they fought the fight long enough, it's time to do something else. So typically, you know, when you have this type of change, it brings a certain amount of upheaval in the short term. I'm not sure that it matters all that much. My grandfather always used to say the cemeteries are full of people who couldn't be replaced. What matters really is we're going to see a new CEO. He's going to want to pick the people around him that he feels can deliver. Some of those will be existing Nokia employees. Some of them will be chosen out of the ranks of Nokia. Some of them may come from elsewhere.
And what about the phones that Nokia has announced at Nokia World? There's the new N8, there's the C series, there's the E7 series, which is aimed at business users. What do you think of those, and do you think they're enough to win that mindshare back?
It's a step forward. It's a big step from 2 years ago where Nokia introduced the N97, and it was fairly lukewarmly received by the market. They sold a lot of them. Again, it's another case where it was, can't say it wasn't a successful product, but it wasn't perceived as particularly innovative or particularly exciting. The devices that they introduced today were a big leap forward. 2 years ago, we would have said they were leading edge devices. A year ago, we might have said they're as good as any device. Today, we'd say they're better than almost everything on the market, but there are devices that are still going to be better, that consumers are going to have more appeal. But you can't solve several years worth of issues in one set of product introductions. It shows that they're thinking about the right things and that they're at least moving in the right direction, which a year ago you might not have said. So, good step forward, not enough, and they're going to have to say, this is what we introduced today, and they're going to have to show where they go from here.
It's also been announced that Jaume Ollier, who's the chairman, who is the former chief executive who led Nokia through its real glory years, is going to be stepping down in 2012. What do you think of that announcement?
Again, I think all things pass in the end, and you have a new CEO. It's not surprising that the chairman may also want to give the CEO the opportunity to do things with a fresh start and have someone else take on that position.
Also, in this week's news, Google launched its Instant Service, which it claims can shorten the time of individual users' searches by up to, get this, 3 seconds on a typical 15-second query. How? Well, it does this by offering predictive searches as you type and updated results as you keep typing in real time. Michael, what has the reaction been to Google Instant? Do people like it, hate it?
I mean, I don't think there's anything to particularly hate about it. If it saves me 3 seconds, well, that's 3 seconds I didn't have before. But most users were not complaining that search has been too slow or that they weren't getting results back fast enough. And when we're down to differentiating by how many seconds it takes through predictive, it means that search is pretty good across the board. And now it's a question of how do I differentiate what my search experience is as opposed to what it used to be, what my search results were.
Do you think this is a response to Bing, or is it a response to mobile demand?
I think it's a response of differentiating, of Google looking to differentiate. And it's interesting because the way they used to differentiate was by uncluttered design, by simplistic, by just that search bar. Now you type it in, things start happening on the screen. I'm looking across the board. And maybe those predictive results don't return necessarily what I'm looking for. So it feels more of a visible differentiation, which is important for Google, as opposed to something that was super valuable. I'm not sure if I'm a Bing user that this will drive me forward. If I was a Google user, I'm not sure this is going to keep me there if the results weren't good. But it shows that everyone's search results are pretty good at this point, and you need new ways of differentiating the search experience to keep the consumer or to win the consumer.
Do you think there's any element in which Google is trying to keep down search engine optimization, pushing results up? Because you said it used to be about how good your results are, and there have been complaints that Google's search results are being cluttered with sort of content farms, in effect, which are just optimized to hell.
There may be things like that, but I think that ingrained reaction of what is on that first page of results, what is on that second page of results, is so tied into consumer behavior at this point that that's going to be hard to change. I'm probably still going to wait until I hit return and see what comes up on those first two pages and not necessarily trust that Google knows exactly what it is I'm looking for.
And finally this week, Apple changed its terms of service for applications developers, a move that suggests that they may be embracing a move towards a more open attitude towards its hardware and its App Store. Previously, developers were told not to develop in Adobe's Flash environment, nor were they or their advertising partners allowed to collect data on their users. Apple held this information very close to its chest. But in a surprising move, which wasn't explained by Apple, the coils have been released somewhat. Now, the question is whether this indicates that Apple thinks that open platforms are more interesting. I have to say, from my perspective, it looks like a defensive move, that they're trying to let people who develop in Flash develop for the Apple platform as well, so that they can have the broadest possible range of applications, that they're trying to make sure developers don't defect to the Android platform or even the Nokia platforms, because all the other phone platforms are trying to get as many developers into their app stores as they can. Apple here clearly having taken a position earlier in the year where it wouldn't let these Flash developers cross-compile to Apple, and now saying, well, if you develop in Flash and it runs on Apple, then that's okay. Although the rules that they put up in their app store document do suggest that if they don't like the look of it, they can still ban it.
Right. And so that's where maybe I'll disagree with you. Apple doesn't need to take a defensive position. They have more developers than they know what to do with. The issue with Flash was a concern that least common denominator environments produce bad applications, because there were two parts of what Apple said. In some ways, they were easing restrictions. In other ways, they said, you know what? We're going to get tougher on you. If you have a lousy app, we're going to say no. The more expensive your app is, the closer we're going to look at it. If you try and do an end run around us by sneaking something in there, we're going to catch you, and we're not going to let you go through. And I think what they did was, by tightening those restrictions, they said, if you're going to try and do a least common denominator app, that's not going to fly. So build it in whatever you want, but it better be a great app. Because if it's not a good app, we're not putting it in our store. And this is our store. We care about what goes on our shelves.
But that was all there before. It's just that they'd never actually made it public. And the thing with the Flash apps was, it was always a worry about least common denominator. They were always saying, in effect, it was never enunciated publicly, but they were saying, we don't like the look of these things because they're not actually built with the Apple apps. They don't have the right sort of tab structure. The user interface isn't quite right.
It also takes away, we started hearing about various government scrutiny going on about these policies. This is a way of Apple saying, it's not us trying to be monopolistic. This is about us caring about very good applications. So you know what? Develop any way you want, but it better be good, because we're going to raise the bar. And if there's 100 apps that already do it, well, you know what? We may not allow 101 because we think it's too many. So I think what they're doing was, with two hands, easing the technical restrictions that they'd come under fire for, and at the same point, raising publicly the editorial restrictions and saying, look, we're doing this in the name of the customer because that's what we care about. These are our phones. We care about what happens on our phones, and we care about the customer experience.
Do you think that retrospectively they'll clear out some of the clutter in there?
It would not surprise me. When you have 250,000 applications, if they said, you know what, let's lop off 10,000. They may decide to grandfather those apps in and just let evolution take their course. Always hard to predict what Apple might or might not do on any given day of the week. But I think what they're saying is, no matter what you see in there today, these are the rules that are going to apply to you going forward. So don't look at what's there. Maybe we'll go back and clean up. Maybe we won't. But we're not putting anything else on the shelf that doesn't meet a certain degree of quality in our view. And since it's our store, we get to make that call.
How do you think it changes the balance vis-a-vis, the Android marketplace, the Nokia Obi store, places like that?
I don't think it changes anything. Developers want to develop for the platform. They go where the users are. They go where the center of gravity is. And they go where the money can be made. And so they're going to continue developing for the platform, as they have.
Nokia would argue that actually it's got the most users. It's got more users on smartphones than Apple has.
Well, and they made it clear, if you're having a problem with us, you better deal with us. Don't make it a public thing, because that's not going to get our attention well. And I think that's what they're tired of, was approving thousands of apps a day, and one developer has a problem, then all of a sudden they blog about it, and it gets picked up by the bloggers and the media, and everything else becomes another issue for Apple to deal with. They're saying, not the way we're going to handle things going forward. So on one hand, we're going to be a little more transparent with you, but you're going to have to work with us. And the store is not the internet. Look, the irony is, Google's store isn't open either. You still have to abide by Google's terms of services. Which are not overly different than Apple's. The only difference is Google's not going to look at the stuff first. They're going to let anyone come in and put the stuff on their shelves. They find out about it afterward. Then they're going to take action, and then they'll do something about it. Apple says, we'd rather you didn't have that bad experience in the first place. We're going to be proactive about it. So the notion that Google is somehow more open than Apple is a bit of a fallacy. It's only a question of, is someone being proactive about it, or is someone being reactive about it?
Michael Gartenberg of the Altimeter Group, thank you very much. Stay tuned to these stories on our website, guardian.co.uk/technology, and get the latest headlines and developments as they arise.
My name is Marshall Chang from Nokia Research Center. I'm based out of Beijing. And what we have here today is a demo called Nokia Plug and Touch. It can transform any display, whether it's a plasma LED, LCD screen, even a projector, into a touchscreen. All you need is your phone, a touchscreen phone with a camera, your TV, and we connect the phone to the TV using an HDMI cable or an AV cable, the phone's camera is facing the television screen. We're looking at the TV screen right here. It's hooked up, and what it's displaying right now is the phone's UI. And the application's already on. And what I'm doing is clicking on an icon on the screen, and it opens up an application. And so we have two gestures. One is a click, the other is vertical scrolling. I'm just waving one hand in front of the screen from top down, bottom up. Some of you guys might be asking why this is important, right? Well, actually, this is part of the gesture UI research we're doing at Nokia Research Center. The key here is trying to figure out how to take the touchscreen experience away from the touchscreen, because we're seeing a lot of development in augmented reality, 3D, UI, and as these technologies become more and more mature, we have to figure out how to interact with the content or even our surroundings. And a lot of people are saying, hey, this would be great for presentations. No longer do I need my laptop computer to take to a meeting and hook it up to the overhead projector. I just need my phone, have everything in there, and now I can present in front of everyone as opposed to just sitting down in front of my laptop computer.
Dr. J. McGonigal is a game developer, but rather than keeping her creations inside the computer, McGonigal has forged an impressive career with clients from Microsoft to McDonald's, making games that take place and change the real world. She works at the think tank, the Institute for the Future, looking at ways to engage the general public in solving some of the biggest questions of our time, from global warming to how to be happy. Now her next motivation is bringing all of the people together who make social games, as she says, for good, in a new social network, Gameful. Welcome to the pod, Jane.
Thanks, Alex.
First of all, tell me a little bit about Gameful.
We're calling it a secret headquarters because, of course, it's for people who make and play games, so it has to be secret and awesome and hard to get into. It's not really secret in the sense that we're not talking about it, obviously. It's kind of more secret in the sense that there are all of these game developers out there in the world trying to use what they've learned about making us happy, making us smarter, more creative, more optimistic, trying to use all that to change the real world. And there are thousands of these people, tens of thousands probably, but nobody really knows about them yet. So we're kind of secret in that sort of hidden in plain sight way. And we're going to come together online and collaborate and support each other and find each other jobs and sponsors and gamers and try and make it less secret.
And hopefully, as you said in your talk today, hopefully get a games designer who will eventually be winning the Nobel Prize in 2023, I think, is your goal.
Yes, 2023. I think we could do it earlier than that now. I said it a couple years ago as a 15-year goal because it seemed reasonable, but now maybe 2020, I think.
So in 2020, Why in the world would the Nobel Committee give a computer games or a games designer the Nobel Peace Prize?
Yeah.
Surely, you know, the idea is that it games are create rifts, they create aggression as opposed to something that would make people peaceful.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have all kinds of ideas, sort of plausible scenarios. One of them is around happiness. It's about raising global quality of life. We know that from scientific research that gamers experience more positive emotions than other people who don't play games, because games spark feelings like pride and curiosity and awe and wonder. We know from non-gaming scientific research that if you experience at least 3 positive emotions for every 1 negative emotion in real life, you live 10 years longer. You are more successful at work, at school, more successful in marriages. And in fact, achieving that positive emotion ratio is more important to your health than quitting a pack-a-day cigarette habit. This is kind of major research that's just come out in the past couple of years. But what it shows is that something like games, which makes us happy, if we can make enough of those games and play enough of them, we can actually transform the health and happiness of the whole planet. And that would be no small feat. I mean, imagine if somebody got the entire world to quit smoking, got the entire world to not be obese, they would win a Nobel Prize. So seems like a game developer should be able to do that as well.
I love your lofty goals, Jane. Keeping things within the realms of reality.
Yeah.
Well, actually, speaking of the realms of reality, you've got a book coming out. I believe it's coming out in January, which talks a lot about these things, and it's called Reality is Broken. Can you tell me a bit about that? Do you actually think reality is broken?
I think that compared to games, reality is broken in a few key ways, particularly around our sense of what we're capable of and our ability to make a difference. I think in game worlds, we have a much greater ability to do something that feels satisfying and meaningful and to connect with other people than we do in the real world. I don't think that virtual reality is preferable than real reality. I think reality is the place to be, but it's just we've screwed it up. We've screwed up the design of the real world. We've screwed up the design of school, of healthcare, of the food that we eat. It's ridiculous. But virtual worlds, we can learn from that and fix reality. So that's the goal of the book, is not to say, like, woo, let's get out. Let's go into the computers. It's to say, you know, geez, we better make the real world better so people don't escape.
And one of those ways is by designing better games.
Well, designing better games, but also designing better real things. You know, I'm looking at a new public school that is designed like a video game, every aspect of the curriculum, looking at healthcare practices. You know, if you're in the hospital, is there a way to make that experience more like a game? So, you know, even flying, like one of my favorite things is like frequent flyer programs, replacing them with big epic MMOs that you can only play while you're on a plane. So making better games, but also just making things more gameful.
Well, interestingly, these things don't necessarily have to be pleasurable, do they? Does a game, something that creates a goal-driven outcome, have to be fun to play?
Oh, that's really interesting, right? There's some people will say no, but my definition of a game, which I get from a Canadian philosopher named Bernard Suits, late great philosopher, sadly no longer with us, the definition is a game is an unnecessary obstacle that we volunteer to overcome or to try to overcome. So I think a game has to be an unnecessary obstacle. It can be really hard, like solving hunger or stopping climate change, but it has to feel optional. And the reason why that is that it triggers positive stress in our brains rather than negative stress. The experience of positive stress and negative stress is basically the same. It's like adrenaline, it's focused attention, it's your heart's racing. But when we have chosen to feel it, it feels good. So it does have to be pleasurable, but it could be something that ordinarily would not be pleasurable. It's the thing that makes a difference is, are we choosing to do it? Do we feel like it's an adventure rather than a chore?
Do you feel that that this is ultimately how we should be leading our lives, how we should design our lives, is to be ultimately goal-driven? Because, you know, some people might just say, hey, that's totally un-Zen, man. Let's just let the world wash over us.
Yeah, well, an exclusive confession on your podcast, I will say that I actually practice Zen Buddhism. And full participation, my favorite Zen, this is weird that we're talking about Zen because I just like love it, but my favorite sort of Zen practitioner, Sherry Huber, she talks about Zen Buddhism is just being fully alive to the possibilities of the moment. And in games, we are fully alive to the possibilities of the moment. They activate that kind of attention and awareness. The goals do kind of make it a little bit different, but at least we're not half dead and unaware.
Well, speaking of some of the lofty goals that you mentioned ending hunger, climate change. Some of these are the goals that you've actually been working on in the games that you've made. Can you tell me a little bit about, for example, World Without Oil?
It was an online simulation. We asked people to live their real lives as if we had run out of oil to the point that it would be costing, you know, twice as much, that we wouldn't be able to get fuel in certain areas, airlines are not able to run properly, food's not delivered, and to document with social media. But we ran it a year before real oil shortage, and then what we found out was that the players who had been through this simulation of an oil shortage had already figured out how to cope with a real shortage, and when the real one happened, they were thriving. They felt empowered. They didn't feel stressed out.
The things that you do design, though, as a game designer, all tend to be very positive. But if you believe that people can learn from these types of games, that can have these positive outcomes where they're more efficacious or they have happiness, why is it okay that people play potentially negative games? How can we protect ourselves, as it were, from the potentially negative effects of being immersed in the virtual realities that game designers who create destructive games?
Yeah. Well, so the rule for me about games is really simple. If a game makes you feel positive emotions, And more positive emotions than negative emotions, 3-to-1, it's a magic ratio. Any game is fine. My husband likes playing all the games with guns and gore, and I'm not so into that. But he feels challenged, and he feels proud when he does it. He plays with his brother, and they feel bonded, and they have to cooperate and trust each other. And for him, that game does the job. It does the positive emotion job. But some people play, like a lot of Halo players, get way too competitive, and they report feeling angry at the end of a match, or they feel stressed out. Some World of Warcraft players say they feel stressed out, like it's another job. So it's really just about monitoring for you. Is this game giving me more positive emotions than negative? And I'm not really a judge of content. It doesn't really matter for me what the content is. You know, there are lots of games that I don't love the content. I wouldn't play it. I wouldn't want my, you know, young kid playing it. But the emotions are the important part, I think.
So you've tackled world hunger. You've tackled climate change. You've tackled our happiness. What's next?
Oh, my God. I'm trying to think of things that I can say that won't get me in trouble. I'm really interested in taking further a game that I playtested on myself last year. I got a head injury last summer, and I wasn't recovering easily, and it was largely because I was so anxious and depressed. And my doctor said that I had to figure out a way not to be anxious or depressed because it actually slows down the brain's healing. And I was like so anxious and depressed about still being sick that there was no way out other than, I thought, to turn my whole recovery process into a game. But now I've got people playtesting it for things other than head injury, for things like newly diagnosed diabetes, asthma, knee surgery, chemotherapy. And it's not like clinical testing or anything yet, but we're just trying to figure out if it really helps other people. So I think reinventing healthcare and making illness and recovery an awesome adventure and not painful and miserable would be next.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
I'm Lynette Farinas. I'm the head of marketing communications for Forum Nokia. So it's the part of Nokia that actually works with third-party developers, and our job is to get the developers noticed and actually get their applications out there to the public. The hackathon is basically something we thought would be exciting for developers to be a part in, where they actually can build applications within a 36-hour time frame. This hackathon is actually based on something called Make My App, which was a contest for consumers to come up with ideas of applications they'd like to see on the N8. We did a lot of crowdsourcing. That's how we got to the top 50. One of them is called Emergency Geotag application, so it's for people who might be in an accident or can't call for help. It'll actually call then the police, and because you're on GPS, it'll find you. And then there's some really good, kind of really technical, complex applications like the facial recognition application. And also some guys are even taking it to the next level by adding facial movements to the application so that if you happen to be a paraplegic or somebody who can't use their fingers, they can actually just use facial movements to be able to control the features of the handset. So right now we're sitting under the clock, and everybody's under the gun actually to finish their applications. They have pretty much just all night and then up till 12 noon to finish their applications, and then turn that into the judges. And the objective is really to get these applications on the N8 and then actually make it available to others on Ovi Store. Hopefully we'll get all these applications up on the store once they're polished within the next week, and they'll be available through a promotion called Make My App applications. So look out for them on Ovi Store.
That's it for Tech Weekly this week, coming to you from Nokia World in London. Many thanks to the pod team, Michael and Charles, and to our guest, Jane McGonigal. The producer this week was Scott Cawley. I'm Alex Kratosky. See you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.